This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Digital Minimalism on Living Better with Less Technology by Cal Newport. Read for you by Will Damron, with an introduction read by the author.
This is the author, Cal Newport. Introduction. In September 2016, the influential blogger and commentator Andrew Sullivan wrote a 7,000-word essay for New York Magazine titled, I Used to Be a Human Being. Its subtitle was alarming. An endless bombardment of news and gossip and images has rendered us manic information addicts. It broke me. It might break you, too. The article was widely shared. I'll admit, however, that when I first read it, I didn't fully comprehend Sullivan's warning. I'm one of the few members of my generation to never have a social media account, and tend not to spend much time web surfing. As a result, my phone plays a relatively minor role in my life, a fact that places me outside the mainstream experience this article addressed. In other words, I knew that the innovations of the internet age were playing an increasingly intrusive role in many people's lives, but I didn't have a visceral understanding of what this meant. That is, until everything changed. Earlier in 2016, I published a book titled Deep Work. It was about the underappreciated value of intense focus and how the professional world's emphasis on distracting communication tools was holding people back from producing their best work. As my book found an audience, I began to hear from more and more of my readers. Some sent me messages while others cornered me after public appearances, but many of them asked the same question. What about their personal lives? They agreed with my arguments about office distractions, but as they then explained, they were arguably even more distressed by the way new technology seemed to be draining meaning and satisfaction from their time spent outside of work. This caught my attention and tumbled me unexpectedly into a crash course on the promises and perils of modern digital life. Almost everyone I spoke to believed in the power of the internet and recognized that it can and should be a force that improves their lives. They didn't necessarily want to give up Google Maps or abandon Instagram, but they also felt as though their current relationship with technology was unsustainable, to the point that if something didn't change soon, they'd break too. A common term I heard in these conversations about modern digital life was exhaustion. It's not that any one app or website was particularly bad when considered in isolation. As many people clarified, the issue was the overall impact of having so many different shiny baubles pulling so insistently at their attention and manipulating their mood. The problem with this frenzied activity is less about its details than the fact that it's increasingly beyond their control. Few want to spend so much time online, but these tools have a way of cultivating behavioral addictions. The urge to check Twitter or refresh Reddit becomes a nervous twitch that shatters uninterrupted time into shards too small to support the presence necessary for an intentional life. As I discovered in my subsequent research and will argue in the next chapter, some of these addictive properties are accidental. Few predicted the extent to which text messaging could command your attention, while many are quite purposeful. Compulsive use is the foundation for many social media business plans. But whatever its source, this irresistible attraction to screens is leading people to feel as though they're ceding more and more of their autonomy when it comes to deciding how they direct their attention. No one, of course, signed up for this loss of control. They downloaded the apps and set up accounts for good reasons, only to discover, with grim irony, that these services were beginning to undermine the very values that made them appealing in the first place. They joined Facebook to stay in touch with friends across the country and then ended up unable to maintain an uninterrupted conversation with the friend sitting across the table. I also learned about the negative impact of unrestricted online activity on psychological well-being. Many people I spoke to understood social media's ability to manipulate their mood. The constant exposure to their friends' carefully curated portrayals of their lives generates feelings of inadequacy, especially during periods when they're already feeling low. And for teenagers, it provides a cruelly effective way to be publicly excluded. In addition, as demonstrated during the 2016 presidential election and its aftermath, online discussion seems to accelerate people's shift toward emotionally charged and draining extremes. The techno-philosopher Jaron Lanier convincingly argues that the primacy of anger and outrage online is, in some sense, an unavoidable feature of the medium. In an open marketplace for attention, darker emotions attract more eyeballs than positive and constructive thoughts. For heavy internet users, repeated interaction with this darkness can become a source of draining negativity, a steep price that many don't even realize they're paying to support their compulsive connectivity. Encountering this distressing collection of concerns, from the exhausting and addictive overuse of these tools to their ability to reduce autonomy, decrease happiness, stoke darker instincts, and distract from more valuable activities, opened my eyes to the fraught relationship so many now maintain with the technologies that dominate our culture. It provided me, in other words, a much better understanding of what Andrew Sullivan meant when he lamented, "I used to be a human being." This experience of talking with my readers convinced me that the impact of technology on people's personal lives was worth deeper exploration. I began more seriously researching and writing on this topic, trying to both better understand its contours and seek out the rare examples of those who can extract great value from these new technologies without losing control. To some, the fact that I can't draw from a deep well of personal experience is a liability. "How can you criticize social media if you've never used it?" is one of the most common complaints I hear in response to my public advocacy on these issues. There's some truth to this claim, but as I recognized back in 2016 when I began this investigation, my outsider status can also prove advantageous. By approaching our tech culture from a fresh perspective, I'm perhaps better able to distinguish assumption from truth and meaningful use from manipulation. One of the first things that became clear during this exploration is that our culture's relationship with these tools is complicated by the fact that they mix harm with benefits. Smartphones, ubiquitous wireless internet, digital platforms that connect billions of people, these are triumphant innovations. Few serious commentators think we'd be better off returning to an earlier technological age. But at the same time, people are tired of feeling like they've become a slave to their devices. This reality creates a jumbled emotional landscape where you can simultaneously cherish your ability to discover inspiring photos on Instagram while fretting about this app's ability to invade the evening hours you used to spend talking with friends or reading. The most common response to these complications is to suggest modest hacks and tips. Perhaps if you observe a digital Sabbath, or keep your phone away from your bed at night, or turn off notifications and resolve to be more mindful, you can keep all the good things that attracted you to these new technologies in the first place while still minimizing their worst impacts. I understand the appeal of this moderate approach because it relieves you of the need to make hard decisions about your digital life. You don't have to quit anything, miss out on any benefits, annoy any friends, or suffer any serious inconveniences. But as is becoming increasingly clear to those who have attempted these types of minor corrections, willpower, tips, and vague resolutions are not sufficient by themselves to tame the ability of new technologies to invade your cognitive landscape. The addictiveness of their design and the strength of the cultural pressure supporting them are too strong for an ad hoc approach to succeed. In my work on this topic, I've become convinced that what you need instead is a full-fledged philosophy of technology use, rooted in your deep values, that provides clear answers to the questions of what tools you should use and how you should use them, and, equally important, enables you to confidently ignore everything else. There are many philosophies that might satisfy these goals. On one extreme, there are the Neo-Luddites, who advocate the abandonment of most new technologies. On another extreme, you have the quantified self enthusiasts, who carefully integrate digital devices into all aspects of their life with the goal of optimizing their existence. Of the different philosophies I studied, however, there is one in particular that stood out as a superior answer for those looking to thrive in our current moment of technological overload. I call it digital minimalism, and it applies the belief that less can be more to our relationship with digital tools. This idea is not new. Long before Henry David Thoreau exclaimed, "Simplicity, simplicity, simplicity," Marcus Aurelius asked, "You see how few things you have to do to live a satisfying and reverent life?" Digital minimalism simply adapts this classical insight to the role of technology in our modern lives. The impact of this simple adaptation, however, can be profound. In this book, you'll encounter many examples of digital minimalists who experienced massively positive changes by ruthlessly reducing their time spent online to focus on a small number of high-value activities. Because digital minimalists spend so much less time connected than their peers, it's easy to think of their lifestyle as extreme, but the minimalists would argue that this perception is backward. What's extreme is how much time everyone else spends staring at their screens. The key to thriving in our high-tech world, they've learned, is to spend much less time using technology. The goal of this book is to make the case for digital minimalism, including a more detailed exploration of what it asks and why it works, and then to teach you how to adopt this philosophy if you decide it's right for you. To do so, I divided the book into two parts. In part one, I describe the philosophical underpinnings of digital minimalism, starting with a closer examination of the forces that are making so many people's digital lives increasingly intolerable, before moving on to a detailed discussion of the digital minimalism philosophy, including my argument for why it's the right solution to these problems. Part 1 concludes by introducing my suggested method for adopting this philosophy, the digital declutter. As I've argued, aggressive action is needed to fundamentally transform your relationship with technology. The digital declutter provides this aggressive action. This process requires you to step away from optional online activities for 30 days. During this period, you'll wean yourself from the cycles of addiction that many digital tools can instill and begin to rediscover the analog activities that provide you deeper satisfaction. You'll take walks, talk to friends in person, engage your community, read books, and stare at the clouds. Most importantly, the declutter gives you the space to refine your understanding of the things you value most. At the end of the 30 days, you will then add back a small number of carefully chosen online activities that you believe will provide massive benefit to these things you value. Going forward, you'll do your best to make these intentional activities the core of your online life, leaving behind most of the other distracting behaviors that used to fragment your time and snare your attention. The declutter acts as a jarring reset. You come into the process a frazzled maximalist and leave an intentional minimalist. In this final chapter of Part 1, I'll guide you through implementing your own digital declutter. In doing so, I'll draw extensively on an experiment I ran in the early winter of 2018, in which over 1,600 people agreed to perform a digital declutter under my guidance and report back about their experience. You'll hear these participants' stories and learn what strategies worked well for them and what traps they encountered that you should avoid. The second part of this book takes a closer look at some ideas that will help you cultivate a sustainable digital minimalism lifestyle. In these chapters, I examine issues such as the importance of solitude and the necessity of cultivating high-quality leisure to replace the time most now dedicate to mindless device use. I propose and defend the perhaps controversial claim that your relationships will strengthen if you stop clicking like or leaving comments on social media posts and become harder to reach by text messages. I also provide an insider look at the attention resistance, a loosely organized movement of individuals who use high-tech tools and strict operating procedures to extract value from the products of the digital attention economy while avoiding falling victim to compulsive use. Each chapter in Part 2 concludes with a collection of practices, which are concrete tactics designed to help you act on the big ideas of the chapter. As a budding digital minimalist, you can view the Part 2 practices as a toolbox meant to aid your efforts to build a minimalist lifestyle that works for your particular circumstances. In Walden, Thoreau famously writes, "The mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation." Less often quoted, however, is the optimistic rejoinder that follows in his next paragraph. "They honestly think there is no choice left. But alert and healthy natures remember that the sun rose clear. It is never too late to give up our prejudices." Our current relationship with the technologies of our hyper-connected world is unsustainable and is leading us closer to the quiet desperation that Thoreau observed so many years ago. But as Thoreau reminds us, the sun rose clear, and we still have the ability to change this state of affairs. To do so, however, we cannot passively allow the wild tangle of tools, entertainments, and distractions provided by the internet age to dictate how we spend our time or how we feel. We must instead take steps to extract the good from these technologies while sidestepping what's bad. We require a philosophy that puts our aspirations and values once again in charge of our daily experience, all the while dethroning primal whims and the business models of Silicon Valley from their current dominance of this role. A philosophy that accepts new technologies, but not if the price is the dehumanization Andrew Sullivan warned us about. a philosophy that prioritizes long-term meaning over short-term satisfaction. A philosophy, in other words, like digital minimalism.
Part 1. Foundations. 1. A lopsided arms race. We didn't sign up for this. I remember when I first encountered Facebook. It was the spring of 2004. I was a senior in college and began to notice an increasing number of my friends talk about a website called thefacebook.com. The first person to show me an actual Facebook profile was Julie, who was then my girlfriend, and now my wife. My memory of it was that it was a novelty, she told me recently. It had been sold to us as a virtual version of our printed freshman directory, something we could use to look up the boyfriends or girlfriends of people we knew. The key word in this memory is novelty. Facebook didn't arrive in our world with a promise to radically transform the rhythms of our social and civic lives. It was just one diversion among many. In the spring of 2004, the people I knew who signed up for the Facebook.com were almost certainly spending significantly more time playing Snood, a Tetris-style puzzle game that was inexplicably popular, than they were tweaking their profiles or poking their virtual friends. It was interesting, Julie summarized, but it certainly didn't seem like this was something on which we would spend any real amount of time. 3 years later, Apple released the iPhone, sparking the mobile revolution. What many forget, however, was that the original revolution promised by this device was also much more modest than the impact it eventually created. In our current moment, smartphones have reshaped people's experience of the world by providing an always-present connection to a humming matrix of chatter and distraction. In January 2007, when Steve Jobs revealed the iPhone during his famous Macworld keynote, the vision was much less grandiose. One of the major selling points of the original iPhone was that it integrated your iPod with your cell phone, preventing you from having to carry around two separate devices in your pockets. This is certainly how I remember thinking about the iPhone's benefits when it was first announced. Accordingly, when Jobs demonstrated an iPhone on stage during his keynote address, he spent the first 8 minutes of the demo walking through its media features, concluding, "It's the best iPod we've ever made." Another major selling point of the device when it launched was the many ways in which it improved the experience of making phone calls. It was big news at the time that Apple forced AT&T to open its voicemail system to enable a better interface for the iPhone. On stage, Jobs was also clearly enamored of the simplicity with which you could scroll through phone numbers and the fact that the dial pad appeared on the screen instead of requiring permanent plastic buttons. "The killer app is making calls," Jobs exclaimed to applause during his keynote. It's not until 33 minutes into that famed presentation that he gets around to highlighting features like improved text messaging and mobile internet access that dominate the way we now use these devices. To confirm that this limited vision was not some quirk of Jobs's keynote script, I spoke with Andy Grignon, who was one of the original iPhone team members. "This was supposed to be an iPod that made phone calls," he confirmed. "Our core mission was playing music and making phone calls." As Grignon then explained to me, Steve Jobs was initially dismissive of the idea that the iPhone would become more of a general-purpose mobile computer running a variety of different third-party applications. "The second we allow some knucklehead programmer to write some code that crashes it," Jobs once told Grignon, "that will be when they want to call 911. When the iPhone first shipped in 2007, there was no app store, no social media notifications, no quick snapping of photos to Instagram, no reason to surreptitiously glance down a dozen times during a dinner. And this was absolutely fine with Steve Jobs and the millions who bought their first smartphone during this period. As with the early Facebook adopters, few predicted how much our relationship with this shiny new tool would mutate in the years that followed. It's widely accepted that new technologies such as social media and smartphones massively changed how we live in the 21st century. There are many ways to portray this change. I think the social critic Lawrence Scott does so quite effectively when he describes the modern hyper-connected existence as one in which a moment can feel strangely flat if it exists solely in itself. The point of the previous observations, however, is to emphasize what many also forget, which is that these changes, in addition to being massive and transformational, were also unexpected and unplanned. A college senior who set up an account on thefacebook.com in 2004 to look up classmates probably didn't predict that the average modern user would spend around 2 hours per day on social media and related messaging services, with close to half that time dedicated to Facebook's products alone. Similarly, a first adopter who picked up an iPhone in 2007 for the music features would be less enthusiastic if told that within a decade he could expect to compulsively check the device 85 times a day, a feature we now know Steve Jobs never considered as he prepared his famous keynote. These changes crept up on us and happened fast before we had a chance to step back and ask what we really wanted out of the rapid advances of the past decade. We added new technologies to the periphery of our experience for minor reasons, then woke one morning to discover that they had colonized the core of our daily life. We didn't, in other words, sign up for the digital world in which we're currently entrenched. We seem to have stumbled backward into it. This nuance is often missed in our cultural conversation surrounding these tools. In my experience, when concerns about new technologies are publicly discussed, techno-apologists are quick to push back by turning the discussion to utility, providing case studies, for example, of a struggling artist finding an audience through social media, or WhatsApp connecting a deployed soldier with her family back home. This example comes from personal experience. In the fall of 2016, I appeared on a national radio show on the CBC network in Canada to discuss a New York Times column I wrote, questioning the benefits of social media for career advancement. The host surprised me early in the interview by bringing into the discussion an unannounced guest, an artist who promotes his work through social media. Funnily enough, not long into the interview, the artist admitted, unprompted, that he was finding social media to be too distracting, and that he now takes long breaks from it to get work done. They then conclude that it's incorrect to dismiss these technologies on the grounds that they're useless, a tactic that is usually sufficient to end the debate. The techno-apologists are right in their claims, but they're also missing the point. The perceived utility of these tools is not the ground on which our growing wariness builds. If you ask the average social media user, for example, why they use Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, they can provide you with reasonable answers. Each one of these services probably offers them something useful that would be hard to find elsewhere. The ability, for example, to keep up with baby pictures of a sibling's child, or to use a hashtag to monitor a grassroots movement. The source of our unease is not evident in these thin-sliced case studies, but instead becomes visible only when confronting the thicker reality of how these technologies as a whole have managed to expand beyond the minor roles for which we initially adopted them. Increasingly, they dictate how we behave and how we feel, and somehow coerce us to use them more than we think is healthy, often at the expense of other activities we find more valuable. What's making us uncomfortable, in other words, is this feeling of losing control, a feeling that instantiates itself in a dozen different ways each day, such as when we tune out with our phone during our child's bath time, or lose our ability to enjoy a nice moment without a frantic urge to document it for a virtual audience. It's not about usefulness. It's about autonomy. The obvious next question, of course, is how we got ourselves into this mess. In my experience, most people who struggle with the online part of their lives are not weak-willed or stupid. They're instead successful professionals, striving students, loving parents. They are organized and used to pursuing hard goals. Yet somehow the apps and sites beckoning from behind the phone and tablet screen, unique among the many temptations they successfully resist daily, manage to succeed in metastasizing unhealthily far beyond their original roles. A large part of the answer about how this happened is that many of these new tools are not nearly as innocent as they might first seem. People don't succumb to screens because they're lazy, but instead because billions of dollars have been invested to make this outcome inevitable. Earlier, I noted that we seem to have stumbled backward into a digital life we didn't sign up for. As I'll argue next, it's probably more accurate to say that we were pushed into it by the high-end device companies and attention economy conglomerates who discovered there are vast fortunes to be made in a culture dominated by gadgets and apps. Tobacco farmers in T-shirts. Bill Maher ends every episode of his HBO show, Real Time, with a monologue. The topics are usually political. This was not the case, however, on May 12, 2017, when Maher looked into the camera and said, "The tycoons of social media have to stop pretending that they're friendly nerd gods building a better world and admit they're just tobacco farmers in T-shirts selling an addictive product to children. Because let's face it, checking your likes is the new smoking." Maher's concern with social media was sparked by a 60 Minutes segment that aired a month earlier. The segment is titled Brain Hacking, and it opens with Anderson Cooper interviewing a lean, red-haired engineer with the carefully tended stubble popular among young men in Silicon Valley. His name is Tristan Harris, a former startup founder and Google engineer who deviated from his well-worn path through the world of tech to become something decidedly rarer in this closed world, a whistleblower. "This thing is a slot machine," Harris says early in the interview, while holding up his smartphone. "How is that a slot machine?" Cooper asks. "Well, every time I check my phone, I'm playing the slot machine to see what did I get," Harris answers. "There's a whole playbook of techniques that get used by technology companies to get you using the product for as long as possible." "Is Silicon Valley programming apps, or are they programming people?" Cooper asks. "They are programming people," Harris says. "There's always this narrative that technology's neutral, and it's up to us to choose how we use it. This is just not true." "Technology is not neutral?" Cooper interrupts. "It's not neutral. They want you to use it in particular ways and for long periods of time, because that's how they make their money." Bill Maher, for his part, thought this interview seemed familiar. After playing a clip of the Harris interview for his HBO audience, Maher quips, "Where have I heard this before?" He then cuts to Mike Wallace's famous 1995 interview with Jeffrey Wigand, the whistleblower who confirmed for the world what most already suspected, that the big tobacco companies engineered cigarettes to be more addictive. "Philip Morris just wanted your lungs," Maher concludes. "The App Store wants your soul." Harris's transformation into a whistleblower is exceptional in part because his life leading up to it was so normal by Silicon Valley standards. Harris, who at the time of this writing is in his mid-30s, was raised in the Bay Area. Like many engineers, he grew up hacking his Macintosh and writing computer code. He went to Stanford to study computer science and, after graduating, started a master's degree working in B.J. Fogg's famed Persuasive Technology Lab, which explores how to use technology to change how people think and act. In Silicon Valley, Fogg is known as the millionaire maker, a reference to the many people who passed through his lab and then applied what they learned to help build lucrative tech startups, a group that includes, among other dot-com luminaries, Instagram co-founder Mike Krieger. Following this established path, Harris, once sufficiently schooled in the art of mind-device interaction, dropped out of the master's program to found Apture, a tech startup that used pop-up factoids to increase the time users spent on websites. In 2011, Google acquired Apture, and Harris was put to work on the Gmail inbox team. It was at Google where Harris, now working on products that could impact hundreds of millions of people's behavior, began to grow concerned. After a mind-opening experience at Burning Man, Harris, in a move straight out of a Cameron Crowe screenplay, wrote a 144-slide manifesto titled "A Call to Minimize Distraction and Respect Users' Attention." Harris sent the manifesto to a small group of friends at Google. It soon spread to thousands in the company, including co-CEO Larry Page, who who called Harris into a meeting to discuss the bold ideas. Page named Harris to the newly invented position of product philosopher. But then, nothing much changed. In a 2016 profile in The Atlantic, Harris blamed the lack of changes to the inertia of the organization and a lack of clarity about what he was advocating. The primary source of friction, of course, is almost certainly more simple. Minimizing distraction and respecting users' attention would reduce revenue. Compulsive use sells, which Harris now acknowledges when he claims that the attention economy drives companies like Google into a race to the bottom of the brainstem. So Harris quit, started a nonprofit called Time Well Spent, with the mission of demanding technology that serves us, not advertising, and went public with his warnings about how far technology companies are going to try to hijack our minds. In Washington, D.C., where I live, it's well known that the biggest political scandals are those that confirm a negative that most people already suspected to be true. This insight perhaps explains the fervor that greeted Harris's revelations. Soon after going public, he was featured on the cover of The Atlantic, interviewed on 60 Minutes and PBS NewsHour, and was whisked off to give a TED Talk. For years, those of us who were grumbling about the seeming ease with which people were becoming slaves to their smartphones were put down as alarmist. But then Harris came along and confirmed what many were increasingly suspecting to be true. These apps and slick sites were not, as Bill Maher put it, gifts from nerd gods building a better world. They were instead designed to put slot machines in our pockets. Harris had the moral courage to warn us about the hidden dangers of our devices. If we want to thwart their worst effects, however, we need to better understand how they're so easily able to subvert our best intentions for our lives. Fortunately, when it comes to this goal, we have a good guide. As it turns out, during the same years when Harris was wrestling with the ethical impact of addictive technology, a young marketing professor at NYU turned his prodigious focus to figuring out how exactly this techno-addiction works. Before 2013, Adam Alter had little interest in technology as a research subject. A business professor with a PhD from Princeton in social psychology, Alter studied the broad question of how features in the world around us influence our thoughts and behavior. Alter's doctoral dissertation, for example, studies how coincidental connections between you and another person can impact how you feel about each other. If you find out you have the same birthday as someone who does something horrible, Alter explained to me, you hate them even more than if you didn't have that information. His first book, Drunk Tank Pink, cataloged numerous similar cases where seemingly small environmental factors create large changes in behavior. The title, for example, refers to a study that showed aggressively drunk inmates at a Seattle naval prison were notably calmed after spending just 15 minutes in a cell painted a particular shade of Pepto-Bismol pink, as were Canadian schoolchildren when taught in a classroom of the same color. The book also reveals that wearing a red shirt on a dating profile will lead to significantly more interest than any other color, and that the easier your name is to pronounce, the faster you'll advance in the legal profession. What made 2013 a turning point for Alter's career was a cross-country flight from New York to L.A. I had grand plans to get some sleep and do some work, he told me. But as we started taxiing to take off, I began playing a simple strategy game on my phone called 2048. When we landed 6 hours later, I was still playing the game. After publishing Drunk Tank Pink, Alter had begun searching for a new topic to pursue, a quest that kept leading him back to a key question. What's the single biggest factor shaping our lives today? His experience of compulsive game playing on his 6-hour flight suddenly snapped the answer into sharp focus. Our screens. By this point, of course, others had already started asking critical questions about our seemingly unhealthy relationship with new technologies like smartphones and video games, but what set Alter apart was his training in psychology. Instead of approaching the issue as a cultural phenomenon, he focused on its psychological roots. This new perspective led Alter inevitably and unambiguously in an unnerving direction: the science of addiction. To many people, addiction is a scary word. In popular culture, it conjures images of drug addicts stealing their mother's jewelry. But to psychologists, addiction has a careful definition that's stripped of these more lurid elements. Here's a representative example. Addiction is a condition in which a person engages in use of a substance or in a behavior for which the rewarding effects provide a compelling incentive to repeatedly pursue the behavior despite detrimental consequences. Until recently, it was assumed that addiction only applied to alcohol or drugs, substances that include psychoactive compounds that can directly change your brain chemistry. As the 20th century gave way to the 21st, however, a mounting body of research suggested that behaviors that did not involve ingesting substances could become addictive in the technical sense defined previously. An important 2010 survey paper, for example, appearing in the American Journal of Drug and Alcohol Abuse, concluded that growing evidence suggests that behavioral addictions resemble substance addictions in many domains. The article points to pathological gambling and internet addiction as two particularly well-established examples of these disorders. When the American Psychiatric Association published its fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM-5, in 2013, it included, for the first time, behavioral addiction as a diagnosable problem. This brings us back to Adam Alter. After reviewing the relevant psychology literature and interviewing relevant people in the technology world, two things became clear to him. First, our new technologies are particularly well-suited to foster behavioral addictions. As Alter admits, the behavioral addictions connected to technology tend to be moderate as compared to the strong chemical dependencies created by drugs and cigarettes. If I force you to quit Facebook, you're not likely to suffer serious withdrawal symptoms or sneak out in the night to an internet cafe to get a fix. On the other hand, these addictions can still be quite harmful to your well-being. You might not sneak out to access Facebook, but if the app is only one tap away on the phone in your pocket, a moderate behavioral addiction will make it really hard to resist checking your account again and again throughout the day. The second thing that became clear to Alter during his research is even more disturbing. Just as Tristan Harris warned, in many cases, these addictive properties of new technologies are not accidents, but instead carefully engineered design features. The natural follow-up question to Alter's conclusions is, what specifically makes new technologies well-suited to foster behavioral addictions? In his 2017 book, Irresistible, which details his study of this topic, Alter explores the many different ingredients that make a given technology likely to hook our brain and cultivate unhealthy use. I want to briefly focus on two forces from this longer treatment that not only seemed particularly relevant to our discussion, but as you'll soon learn, repeatedly came up in my own research on how tech companies encourage behavioral addiction: intermittent positive reinforcement and the drive for social approval. Our brains are highly susceptible to these forces. This matters because many of the apps and sites that keep people compulsively checking their smartphones and opening browser tabs often leverage these hooks to make themselves nearly impossible to resist. To understand this claim, let's briefly discuss both. We begin with the first force, intermittent positive reinforcement. Scientists have known since Michael Zeiler's famous pecking pigeon experiments from the 1970s that rewards delivered unpredictably are far more enticing than those delivered with a known pattern. Something about unpredictability releases more dopamine, a key neurotransmitter for regulating our sense of craving. The original Zeiler experiment had pigeons pecking a button that unpredictably released a food pellet. As Adam Alter points out, this same basic behavior is replicated in the feedback buttons that have accompanied most social media posts since Facebook introduced the like icon in 2009. It's hard to exaggerate how much the like button changed the psychology of Facebook use, Alter writes. What had begun as a passive way to track your friends' lives was now deeply interactive, and with exactly the sort of unpredictable feedback that motivated Zeiler's pigeons. Alter goes on to describe users as gambling every time they post something on a social media platform. Will you get likes, or hearts, or retweets, or will it languish with no feedback? The former creates what one Facebook engineer calls bright dings of pseudo-pleasure, while the latter feels bad. Either way, the outcome is hard to predict, which, as the psychology of addiction teaches us, makes the whole activity of posting and checking maddeningly appealing. Social media feedback, however, is not the only online activity with this property of unpredictable reinforcement. Many people have the experience of visiting a content website for a specific purpose, say, for example, going to a newspaper site to check the weather forecast, and then find themselves 30 minutes later still mindlessly following trails of links, skipping from one headline to another. This behavior can also be sparked by unpredictable feedback. Most articles end up duds, but occasionally you'll land on one that creates a strong emotion, be it righteous anger or laughter. Every appealing headline clicked or intriguing link tabbed is another metaphorical pull of the slot machine handle. Technology companies, of course, recognize the power of this unpredictable positive feedback hook and tweak their products with it in mind to make their appeal even stronger. As whistleblower Tristan Harris explains, apps and websites sprinkle intermittent variable rewards all over their products because it's good for business. Attention-catching notification badges, or the satisfying way a single finger swipe swoops in the next potentially interesting post, are often carefully tailored to elicit strong responses. As Harris notes, the notification symbol for Facebook was originally blue to match the palette of the rest of the site, but no one used it, so they changed the color to red, an alarm color, and clicking skyrocketed. In perhaps the most telling admission of all, in the fall of 2017, Sean Parker, the founding president of Facebook, spoke candidly at an event about the attention engineering deployed by his former company. The thought process that went into building these applications, Facebook being the first of them, was all about, how do we consume as much of your time and conscious attention as possible? And that means that we need to sort of give you a little dopamine hit every once in a while, because someone liked or commented on a photo or a post or whatever. The whole social media dynamic of posting content and then watching feedback trickle back unpredictably seems fundamental to these services, but as Tristan Harris points out, it's actually just one arbitrary option among many for how they could operate. Remember that early social media sites featured very little feedback. Their operations focused instead on posting and finding information. It tends to be these early, pre-feedback era features that people cite when explaining why social media is important to their life. When justifying Facebook use, for example, many will point to something like the ability to find out when a friend's new baby is born, which is a one-way transfer of information that does not require feedback. It's implied that people like this news. In other words, there's nothing fundamental about the unpredictable feedback that dominates most social media services. If you took these features away, you probably wouldn't diminish the value most people derive from them. The reason this specific dynamic is so universal is because it works really well for keeping eyes glued to screens. These powerful psychological forces are a large part of what Harris had in mind when he held up a smartphone on 60 Minutes and told Anderson Cooper, "This thing is a slot machine." Let's now consider the second force that encourages behavioral addiction, the drive for social approval. As Adam Alter writes, "We're social beings who can't ever completely ignore what other people think of us." This behavior, of course, is adaptive. In Paleolithic times, it was important that you carefully managed your social standing with other members of your tribe, because your survival depended on it. In the 21st century, however, new technologies have hijacked this deep drive to create profitable behavioral addictions. Consider, once again, social media feedback buttons. In addition to delivering unpredictable feedback, as discussed previously, This feedback also concerns other people's approval. If lots of people click the little heart icon under your latest Instagram post, it feels like the tribe is showing you approval, which we're adapted to strongly crave. For a good introduction to the evolution of groupish instincts in human beings and their central role in how we make sense of the world, see Jonathan Haidt's illuminating book, The Righteous Mind, New York, Pantheon, 2012. The other side of this evolutionary bargain, of course, is that a lack of positive feedback creates a sense of distress. This is serious business for the Paleolithic brain, and therefore it can develop an urgent need to continually monitor this vital information. The power of this drive for social approval should not be underestimated. Leah Perlman, who was a product manager on the team that developed the like button for Facebook, she was the author of the blog post announcing the feature in 2009, has become so wary of the havoc it causes that now, as a small business owner, she hires a social media manager to handle her Facebook account so she can avoid exposure to the service's manipulation of the human social drive. "Whether there's a notification or not, it doesn't really feel that good," Perlman said about the experience of checking social media feedback. "Whatever we're hoping to see, it never quite meets that bar." A similar drive to regulate social approval helps explain the current obsession among teenagers to maintain Snapchat streaks with their friends, as a long, unbroken streak of daily communication is a satisfying confirmation that the relationship is strong. It also explains the universal urge to immediately answer an incoming text, even in the most inappropriate or dangerous conditions. Think behind the wheel. Our Paleolithic brain categorizes ignoring a newly arrived text the same as snubbing the tribe member trying to attract your attention by the communal fire, a potentially dangerous social faux pas. The technology industry has become adept at exploiting this instinct for approval. Social media, in particular, is now carefully tuned to offer you a rich stream of information about how much or how little your friends are thinking about you at the moment. Tristan Harris highlights the example of tagging people in photos on services like Facebook, Snapchat, and Instagram. When you post a photo using these services, you can tag the other users who also appear in the photo. This tagging process sends the target of the tag a notification. As Harris explains, these services now make this process near automatic by using cutting-edge image recognition algorithms to figure out who is in your photos and offer you the ability to tag them with just a single click, an offer usually made in the form of a quick yes or no question. Do you want to tag? To which you'll almost certainly answer yes. This single click requires almost no effort on your part, but to the user being tagged, the resulting notification creates a socially satisfying sense that you were thinking about them. As Harris argues, these companies didn't invest the massive resources necessary to perfect this auto-tagging feature because it was somehow crucial to their social network's usefulness. They instead made this investment so they could significantly increase the amount of addictive nuggets of social approval that their apps could deliver to their users. As Sean Parker confirmed in describing the design philosophy behind these features, it's a social validation feedback loop. Exactly the kind of thing that a hacker like myself would come up with, because you're exploiting a vulnerability in human psychology. Let's step back for a moment to review where we stand. In the preceding sections, I detailed a distressing explanation for why so many people feel as though they've lost control of their digital lives. The hot new technologies that emerged in the past decade or so are particularly well suited to foster behavioral addictions, leading people to use them much more than they think is useful or healthy. Indeed, as revealed by whistleblowers and researchers like Tristan Harris, Sean Parker, Leah Perlman, and Adam Alter, these technologies are in many cases specifically designed to trigger this addictive behavior. Compulsive use, in this context, is not the result of a character flaw, but instead the realization of a massively profitable business plan. We didn't sign up for the digital lives we now lead. They were instead, to a large extent, crafted in boardrooms to serve the interests of a select group of technology investors. a lopsided arms race. As argued, our current unease with new technologies is not really about whether or not they're useful. It's instead about autonomy. We signed up for these services and bought these devices for minor reasons, to look up friends' relationship statuses or eliminate the need to carry a separate iPod and phone, and then found ourselves, years later, increasingly dominated by their influence, allowing them to control more and more of how we spend our time, how we feel, and how we behave. The fact that our humanity was routed by these tools over the past decade should come as no surprise. As I just detailed, we've been engaging in a lopsided arms race in which the technologies encroaching on our autonomy were preying with increasing precision on deep-seated vulnerabilities in our brains, while we still naively believed that we were just fiddling with fun gifts handed down from the nerd gods. When Bill Maher joked that the App Store was coming for our souls, he was actually onto something. As Socrates explained to Phaedrus in Plato's famous chariot metaphor, our soul can be understood as a chariot driver struggling to rein two horses, one representing our better nature and the other our baser impulses. When we increasingly cede autonomy to the digital, we energize the latter horse and make the chariot driver's struggle to steer increasingly difficult, a diminishing of our soul's authority. When seen from this perspective, it becomes clear that this is a battle we must fight. But to do so, we need a more serious strategy, something custom-built to swat aside the forces manipulating us toward behavioral addictions, and that offers a concrete plan about how to put new technologies to use for our best aspirations and not against them. Digital minimalism is one such strategy. It's toward its details that we now turn our attention. 2. Digital minimalism. A minimal solution. Around the time I started working on this chapter, a columnist for the New York Post published an op-ed titled, "How I Kicked the Smartphone Addiction, and You Can Too." His secret? He disabled notifications for 112 different apps on his iPhone. "It's relatively easy to retake control," he optimistically concludes. These types of articles are common in the world of technology journalism. The author discovers that his relationship with his digital tools has become dysfunctional. Alarmed, he deploys a clever life hack, then reports enthusiastically that things seem much better. I'm always skeptical about these quick-fix tales. In my experience covering these topics, it's hard to permanently reform your digital life through the use of tips and tricks alone. The problem is that small changes are not enough to solve our big issues with new technologies. The underlying behaviors we hope to fix are ingrained in our culture, and, as I argued in the previous chapter, they're backed by powerful psychological forces that empower our base instincts. To reestablish control, we need to move beyond tweaks and instead build our relationship with technology from scratch, using our deeply held values as a foundation. The New York Post columnist just cited, in other words, should look beyond the notification settings on his 112 apps and ask the more important question of why he uses so many apps in the first place. What he needs, what all of us who struggle with these issues need, is a philosophy of technology use. Something that covers from the ground up which digital tools we allow into our life, for what reasons, and under what constraints. In the absence of this introspection, we'll be left struggling in a whirlwind of addictive and appealing cyber trinkets, vainly hoping that the right mix of ad hoc hacks will save us. As I mentioned in the introduction, I have one such philosophy to propose. Digital minimalism. A philosophy of technology use in which you focus your online time on a small number of carefully selected and optimized activities that strongly support things you value, and then happily miss out on everything else. The so-called digital minimalists who follow this philosophy constantly perform implicit cost-benefit analyses. If a new technology offers little more than a minor diversion or trivial convenience, the minimalist will ignore it. Even when a new technology promises to support something the minimalist values, it must still pass a stricter test. Is this the best way to use technology to support this value? If the answer is no, the minimalist will set to work trying to optimize the tech, or search out a better option. By working backward from their deep values to their technology choices, digital minimalists transform these innovations from a source of distraction into tools to support a life well lived. By doing so, they break the spell that has made so many people feel like they're losing control to their screens. Notice, this minimalist philosophy contrasts starkly with the maximalist philosophy that most people deploy by default, a mindset in which any potential for benefit is enough to start using a technology that catches your attention. A maximalist is very uncomfortable with the idea that anyone might miss out on something that's the least bit interesting or valuable. Indeed, when I first started writing publicly about the fact that I've never used Facebook, people in my professional circles were aghast for exactly this reason. "Why do I need to use Facebook?" I would ask. "I can't tell you exactly," they would respond. "But what if there's something useful to you in there that you're missing?" This argument sounds absurd to digital minimalists because they believe that the best digital life is formed by carefully curating their tools to deliver massive and unambiguous benefits. They tend to be incredibly wary of low-value activities that can clutter up their time and attention and end up hurting more than they help. Put another way, minimalists don't mind missing out on small things. What worries them much more is diminishing the large things they already know for sure make a good life good. To make these abstract ideas more concrete, let's consider some real-world examples of digital minimalists I uncovered in my research on this emerging philosophy. For some of these minimalists, the requirement that a new technology strongly supports deep values led to the rejection of services and tools that our culture commonly believes to be mandatory. Tyler, for example, originally joined the standard social media services for the standard reasons: to help his career, to keep him connected, and to provide entertainment. Once Tyler embraced digital minimalism, however, he realized that although he valued all three of these goals, his compulsive use of social networks offered at best minor benefits and did not qualify as the best way to use technology for these purposes. So he quit all social media to pursue more direct and effective ways to help his career, connect with other people, and be entertained. I met Tyler roughly a year after his minimalist decision to leave social media. He was clearly excited by how his life had changed during this period. He started volunteering near his home. He exercises regularly. He's reading 3 to 4 books a month. He began to learn to play the ukulele. And he told me that now that his phone is no longer glued to his hand, he's closer than he has ever been with his wife and kids. On the professional side, the increased focus he achieved after leaving these services earned him a promotion. "Some of my work clients have noticed a change in me, and they will ask what I am doing differently," he told me. "When I tell them I quit social media, their response is, 'I wish I could do that, but I just can't.' The reality, however, is that they literally have no good reason to be on social media." As Tyler is quick to admit, he can't completely attribute all of these good things to his specific decision to quit social media. In theory, he could have still learned the ukulele or spent more time with his wife and kids while maintaining a Facebook account. His decision to leave these services, however, was about more than a tweak to his digital habits. It was a symbolic gesture that reinforced his new commitment to the minimalist philosophy of working backward from your deeply held values when deciding how to live your life. Adam provides another good example of this philosophy, leading to the rejection of a technology that we've been told is fundamental. Adam runs a small business, and the ability to remain connected to his employees is important for his livelihood. Recently, however, he became worried about the example he was setting for his 9 and 13-year-old kids. He could talk to them about the importance of experiencing life beyond a glowing screen, he realized, but the message wouldn't stick until they saw him demonstrating this behavior in his own life. So he did something radical. He got rid of his smartphone and replaced it with a basic flip phone. I have never had a better teachable moment in my life, he told me about his decision. My kids know my business depends on a smart device and saw how much I used it, and here I was giving it up. I was able to clearly explain why, and they got it. As Adam admits, the loss of his smartphone made certain things in his work life more annoying. In particular,